Hello, and welcome to the Word Theatre Short Story Podcast. My name is Cedaring Fox. I'm Word Theatre's founder and artistic director. Just so you know up front, full disclosure, Word Theatre is on a mission to make a better world by sharing the world's finest stories brought to life by acclaimed actors. Today, we are offering a beautiful recording of a story by a woman who has been a New Yorker darling for six decades, Laura Siegel. People who are supporting enthusiast and patron members of Word Theatre were treated to a live Zoom performance of this story. It was read by Harriet Walter, who happens to be a dame in the UK. It was followed by a Q&A with the author and the actor. The event was so gorgeous that we decided we must share it with you all in hopes that you too will join us and support us. To introduce one of her earliest stories that had a profound effect on her career and the world's appreciation and understanding of this woman, please welcome the author, Laura Siegel.
I'm Laura Siegel, and I am here at the invitation of Word Theatre to introduce Harriet Walter's reading of a story that I wrote in the 80s. It was actually the first chapter of my novel, Her First American. The book was called Ilka's First American, but this story is the first chapter. It was called Her First American. And it tells how my heroine and my hero meet in Middle America and become acquainted with each other and part. It's a complicated story. It does represent certainly a novelized portion of my own experience. I've heard the reading of Harriet's reading, and it is quite wonderful and illuminating to the writer. I hope you enjoy it and hope you are faithful to Word Theatre, which does these wonderful events. Thank you very much.
Ilka Weissnichs had been 3 months in this country when she went west and discovered her first American. Sitting on a stool in a bar in the desert across from the railroad. He bought her a whiskey and asked her what in the name of the blessed Jehoshaphat she was doing in Cowtown, Nevada.
Nevada, Ilka said. I have believed I'm being in Utah, isn't it?
Utah. The face of the big American turned a sick gray color. Where the hell am I? He asked the barman.
Hagen, replied the barman, swiping a dish towel at a glass beer mug. S end of no place, Nevada.
Ah, so.
Ilka sipped her whiskey and hiding her smile inside her glass said, I do not believe.
What don't you believe? Asked the American.
That I sit in Utah.
Nevada, the man said. I do not believe Nevada, Utah, America.
Ilka was 21. It had taken her more than a decade to get from Vienna to New York. She'd left in 1938 when Hitler came. The Austrian Weissnichses had known so little of their relations, the Litvak Fischgoppers. Ilka had been unaware that she had an American cousin until sometime after the end of the war, when the cousin traced Ilka's whereabouts and sent her a visa and an air ticket. Fischgoppel had come into New York to meet the new refugee at Idlewild.
Ich muss nehmen ein Examen. Ich muss gehen back to school, shouted Fischgoppel across the roar and shriek of the subway that was carrying them uptown. Ihr will stay in mein apartment in New York, okay? Excuse, please,
Ilka had shouted back.
I'm sorry, my horrible Yiddish,
yelled Fischgoppel and hit herself in the head.
Yiddish? Shouted Ilka, lighting on the only word she understood. By us in Vienna has nobody speaking Yiddish outside the Polishen.
What? Hollered Fischgoppel. And they laughed and turned out both palms of their hands, understanding each other to mean too noisy. One can't even talk. Fischgoppel's small Upper West Side apartment had the simple layout of a dumbbell. The front door opened into the middle of a narrow foyer with a room at each end.
One for you, said Fischgoppel, and one for your mother when we get her to America.
I don't know where my mother is. I don't know if she lives, said Ilka. She looked around at Fishgoppel's possessions. Each object was out of harmony with every other in a way for which the laws of probability did not account. Ilka looked at Fishgoppel. Only a persevering spirit could have parlayed that pure skin and wonderful black hair and those sweet, clever eyes into such dowdiness.
"Look at the time," cried Fishgoppel. "Here is a dictionary. Here is the map of the subway. This is where you get off for the employment agency. Here's where they give English classes. Are you going to manage?"
"Thanks," said Ilka.
"The butcher on the corner of Broadway speaks German. The shul is two blocks that way.
Excuse me?
Here is my number. Call me. I'll call you. I'll come in for the day as soon as my exams are over. Will you be all right?"
"Yes, thanks," said Ilka.
"Don't," cried Fishgoppel. "Don't thank me."
Minutes after Fishgoppel had run to catch the train back to New Haven, Ilka took the elevator down and burst into the streets of New York, which looked like the streets of Ilka's childhood Vienna, the same flat, staid, grey facades, except that here, right in front of her, walked a real American couple having an American conversation. Ilka ran to catch up and walked close behind them. She understood the old man saying, "Because I wear proper shoes in which a person can walk." The old woman said, "Because you don't have bunions." The man said, "Because I wear proper shoes." And Ilka recognized that it was German they were speaking, with the round Viennese vowels cushioned between relaxed Viennese consonants. When Ilka got back to the apartment, the telephone was ringing for Fishgoppel. Would Fishgoppel collect on the sixth floor for the United Negro College Fund?
"I will collect. I am the cousin from Fishgoppel," said Ilka, who wanted to get a look into, to get inside American homes.
The nameplate outside apartment 6A said Wolfgang Platschek. He handed her 50 cents through the cracked door. While 6B went to look for change, Ilka put her head inside the foyer and saw the little green marble boy extracting the same splinter from his foot on the same tree stump, on the same round lace doily on which he had sat in Ilka's mother's foyer in Vienna. The woman came back.
"Nix, nothing," she said. It did her grief, but her man was not to house.
6C was Fishgoppel, and 6D would not open, but the voice through the peephole came from Berlin. It did her grief also, but her sister had a stroke and was to bed.
"How?" Ilka asked the woman at the employment agency when she told Ilka to go away and practice her English. "With whom shall I practice when you are the only American I met in New York? The only others that I met in my English class are yet other outlanders, which know always only yet other outlanders, which know yet lesser English as I."
The woman on the other side of the desk drew her head back from the assault of Ilka's complaining. She was a fat woman with a lot of corseted and useless bosom. She looked as if there was some complaining she might do, give her half a chance.
"New York," she finally said to Ilka, "is not America, like all you people always think."
The next time Fishgoppel came in to see how Ilka was managing, Ilka complained to her that New York was not America. Fishgoppel frowned, did some mental arithmetic, and offered Ilka the week's trip west. Fishgoppel returned to New Haven, and Ilka went west. She practiced her English with the train conductor. He leaned over the back of the seat in front of Ilka and asked her to guess how long he'd been on this Denver to Los Angeles run.
"Excuse me?"
Ilka smiled the self-conscious smile she knew from her mirror and regretted. It exposed her two long front teeth with a little gap between and made her look, she believed, like a friendly village simpleton. She was a thin girl. In certain lights, her hair matched the color of her eyes, which Ilka thought of as khaki. She smiled apologetically and sweetly at the round, red-faced conductor. He looked like a healthy old baby. He held up three left and two right fingers.
32 years.
"Aha," said Ilka.
"Know it like,"
he pointed to the inside of his pocket, "like the and he held up the palm of his hand and pointed at it.
"I'll be back," he promised. Ilka looked out at land as level as the primordial water before the creation of breath disturbed its surface, uninterrupted by any object, man-made or natural, as far as the ruler straight horizon, except outside the window on her left, where a grid of apartment buildings formed a small square city whose near perimeter coincided with the railroad platform. The train stopped when it had aligned Ilka with Main Street, at the far end of which stood a mountain like a giant purple ice cream cone turned upside down on the perfectly flat world. Ilka wanted somebody to laugh with, to turn to it and say, "I don't believe this." She might have imagined that she had imagined this Atlantis onto the desert floor, but for the details, which were not in her experience to engender, bars, bowling alleys, barber shops, numberless eating places with neon signs that ran and jumped and stopped and switched from pastel green to pale yellows to pink, leached out by the tail end of daylight. Ilka's conductor returned. He multiplied his 10 fingers by thrusting them into Ilka's face 9 separate times. "A 90-minute stopover," he handed her down the steps. And that was how Ilka Weissnichs from Vienna came to stand in the middle of the new world. Ilka thought she was in Utah, and she thought Utah was dead in the heart of America. Ilka was very excited. She ran up the platform until it stopped, across from the long, low building which formed the northwest corner of the square little town. The building was made of a rosy, luminescent brick and quivered in the blue haze of the oncoming night. It levitated. Its classic windows and square white letters saying "American Glue, Inc." moved Ilka with a sense of beauty so out of proportion with its object, she recognized euphoria. It knocked out her common sense of time. Afraid of being left behind, but more afraid that she might miss what more there might be to be seen, Ilka turned and ran close alongside the train until the platform stopped across from the shack, which held the northeast end of town down upon the desert, the way one of those little gummed corners fixes your snapshot in place on the page of a photograph album. The shack had a roof like a cocked hat slipped down over one eye. A neon sign said, "Lars Brr and Eats." With the reluctance of someone who sticks a foot into an alien element, Ilka stepped off the platform onto the dirt road, crossed to the other side, and with a palpitating heart, depressed the handle of the door. The thin man behind the bar went on wiping a glass with an agitated white dishcloth. But the elderly American swiveled on his bar stool to see who had come in. He was a very large, very stout man with grizzled hair, cut peculiarly short and flattened against the big skull in a way the girl did not understand. His skin had a yellow hue. The nose was flat, the mouth wide, like a frog's, Ilka would have thought, if it had not been for a look about him of weightiness. "Like a Roman senator," thought Ilka. Feeling herself looked at, Ilka had ducked into the booth nearest the door. By the time she raised her self-conscious smile, the big American had returned to his conversation with the barman. There were women who got looked at longer, Ilka knew that. Anyway, he was an older man, and what Ilka had come west for was American conversation. Ilka listened and thought the barman said, "Coming down cats and dogs. But I mean something fierce." And thinking she hadn't been listening properly, she listened harder. The barman said, "This kid I knew in high school's dad is in a cab coming down Lex," I think it was. The man on the bar stool said, "This is in New York," which Ilka understood. She felt encouraged and leaned closer and listened. The barman said, "Where else is there? Guess the brakes quit on the guy, this kid's dad. He lost his thumb, busted both legs,
Left side of his face is all chewed up, and this pip of a shyster out of nowhere is running alongside the stretcher, says he can get him a lump sum in compensation. That's what I'm telling you is what you have to have once in your lifetime. Give you an opportunity. Ilka was trying to connect shyster, the English cognate presumably of the German scheißen, and lump, as in mattress, plus sum, the mathematical result of totting up, and she'd missed everything the barman said after that. She forgot to listen and studied the red plastic booth she sat in. Ilka thought that the back seats of two automobiles had been taken out and placed face to face. Three booths times two back seats in each made six red automobiles. The barman said, got the wife to sue for deprivation of sexual excess or whatever. Access, suggested the older man on the stool. You name it, he sued for it. The barman was coming round the bar and walking towards Ilka, saying, physical torment, language, diminished reproductivity. What'll it be? He asked Ilka. Excuse, please, said Ilka, and smiled at him with her apologetic teeth and shook her head. I cannot yet so well English. The barman, who seemed worn to bone and nerve by a chronic high of exasperation, picked a shred of plastic off the flaking red seat while his foot kicked the center leg to see if the table held. He raised his chin like a dog about to howl and said, you want a drink? Please, coffee? Said Ilka. Coffee! Howled the barman in a voice outside the human range of sound. He walked back around the bar and disappeared through a door into a region beyond Ilka's sight and outside the range of her imagination. She pictured a blackness out of which the barman's voice went on with what he'd been telling the man on the barstool. This kid's dad comes out of the hospital, has lost his hearing in 1 year, or wishes he lost it, is what he used to tell us kids, so he wouldn't hear his noise all the time, like someone pissing inside his ear, loud like Niagara. Jesus, the man on the stool said, that could drive a man to drink. Only thing could drown it out was trumpets, turned with the volume all the way up. See, said the barman, this is hi-fi coming in. This guy, he buys every damn book, reads up in the magazines, and goes into audio with his lump sum in compensation and makes a mint. Owns his own home in Bayshead. But you don't get a lump sum, said the barman, coming out with Ilka's cup of coffee. You don't get an opportunity. I don't care what anybody's going to tell you. And that's true, too, said the stout older man. He raised his voice to the tenor pitch by the door that best carried it into the booth, where the young blonde sat and watched him. The problem, as I see it, is how you're going to put your idea over. My idea? Said the barman. You want me to introduce in the United Nations for you this idea. Ilka was surprised at the high, hilarious note coming from the weighty-looking older man. Or were you thinking in terms of amendment to the Bill of Rights? Was I thinking, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men have the inalienable right to a lump sum. Once in your lifetime, said the barman, that's all I'm saying to you. See, if I understand you now, is this for white only or Negro as well? Listen, I ain't prejudiced like your local cowboys. I'm from New York, said the barman. Ain't I standing here talking to you like a person? You want to make your sandwich? Jesus God, the man on the stool said gaily. Imagine every one of us black sons of a gun going to have an equal opportunity to get our thumbs, legs, and eardrums busted, same as any white man in the land. Let me check this out with you. Everybody has to first get pretty much chewed up, is what you're saying? That's what it's compensation for. The way I figure it, you don't get something for nothing. But how is it now you get nothing, period? It's an idea, said the man on the stool, that will revolutionize the economy. It is? It will? The barman looked nervous. Sure, the man on the stool said. He crossed one ankle over the other, affecting a quarter turn in Ilka's direction. Say you take the Social Security money for the year X, and instead of pissing it away on the poor, the old, and the sick, you divvy it up. Let's say
$3,000 apiece to every baby born that same year, black and white. And stick with me here. The government invests each baby's $3,000 at, say, 5% till the babies get to be 29, or would you say 35? 35 has more horse sense, said the barman. Okay, now, said the man on the stool. When the babies are 35, they cut off their thumbs, break their legs, pierce their eardrums, and give each and every one of them the lump sum of... He patted his breast pocket, took out an envelope and said, you got a pencil there? Thank you. 3,000 at 5% times 35 compounded. The man on the stool did arithmetic for a while. Dollars, 15,760, he said triumphantly. The barman looked agitated. And the poor old sick folks? What poor old sick folks? Cried the man on the stool. They got their lumps when they were 35 and made a mint. They own their own homes, Negroes, whites, everybody, in Bayshead. I guess, said the barman. Ilka had stopped listening. She studied the expanse of the older man's tweed back. It was an autumnal mixture of heather flecked with rust, mauve, green. Ilka had observed that same easy angle of the wrist of the hand which held the cigarette in other men and women too. She thought it connoted the carnal know-how she despaired of for herself. Ilka could see the man's tongue laughing inside his enormous mouth. She'd never seen a grown person laugh so loudly for such a long time, with the mouth so wide open. Now he raised his eloquent right hand. He beckoned. Ilka turned to see who might have come in the door behind her, but there was no one to claim the gesture. And she turned back with a conscious smile, trusting it to double for an acknowledgement in case he meant her, and a general complacence if he hadn't. You ever get yours? The man asked the barman. Worse luck, said the barman. I was in construction, damn near killed in a cave-in. Man, what a mess. See, now, here's what I'm telling you. When they sussed to give me $30 Saturday night, by Monday morning, like you said, I pissed it away. What else is there? But you put 5,000 smackaroos into my hand, I'm a capitalist. I'm going to hang on to every lousy buck. I'm going to make something of myself. What did you do? I read where they were building this four-lane highway, and I come out here. I see the surveyors with my own eyes outside this window. I figure I buy this place cheap. The big money wants to be on Maine and do it up nice, like New York. They can't tell anymore. But 10 years ago, this place was, sharp. I figure every one of the fellas be coming in here for his breakfast, lunch, a home away from home, and booze it up nights for the 3 or whatever years it's going to take them to build me a highway up to my front door. I sell out at a price, go back, and open a classy place on Third Avenue. How can I lose? What happened? The man on the stool asked. They built the highway 4 miles on the other side of town is what happened. You're going to sell out then? To who? You going to be fool enough to take my monkey and put it on your back? Are you? No, you're not. You got the custom from the railroad, the man said. All right, the barman said. There's the 10:45 a.m. Denver to L.A. and the 12:15 L.A. to Denver and the 5:40 you got off of and the 8 p.m. the lady come on, he indicated Ilka, listening in her booth. Maybe a couple rednecks drop in for a beer and put 2 nickels in the juke. You want another bourbon? Maybe the lady will join me? He did mean me, thought Ilka, gratified. It was me, he beckoned. Will you have a drink? Thanks, no, said Ilka. I must soon back in the train, thanks. But the man had risen and was standing with a nice formality next to his stool. It took Ilka time to extricate her feet from under the table and walk across the floor. The man waited until she'd seated herself before resuming his own stool. He offered her a cigarette. Thanks, no. Ilka did not smoke. What would she like to drink? Ilka did not drink. No, thanks. Liquor makes me, how do you say it in English?
Sich übergeben. To overgive the self. You can maybe German?
A little Swahili, the man offered.
Excuse, please?
I don't know German. I'm sorry.
Ilka did a charade and he said, liquor makes you throw up?
No, it doesn't. To the barman, he said, the lady will have a black and white diluted with a little water. Start her off nice and easy.
I'll teach you how to drink, he told Ilka. You are living here? Ilka asked him.
Christ, no, the man said.
He told Ilka that he was en route from California to New York for a brand new start and had stopped off to have himself one last big bender. Speak, please, slower, said Ilka.
I'm going to tie one on, explained the man.
And it was here that he had asked what in the name of the Blessed Jehoshaphat she was doing in Cowtown, Nevada, which Ilka had mistaken and was for the years to come to persist in mistaking for Utah. Ilka said, I search for Americans, except the woman from the employment office. You are my first real.
Real? The man leaned his ear toward her.
A real American, said Ilka.
Of the second class, said the big man.
Ilka shook her head and said, I think every moment I'm understanding lesser and lesser. It was here that Carter Bayou introduced himself. He said, I'm a wonderful teacher. My name is Ilonka Weissnicks, said Ilka, and I want to learn. She made a large inclusive gesture. This all. They shook hands. He said, let me buy you a sandwich. What do you like? Ilka smiled inside her glass and said, I cannot the names of the American sandwich.
You make Rubens? The man asked the barman. Do fish swim? Is what Ilka thought the barman replied before he disappeared back into his private darkness.
You don't look like a teacher, said Ilka and blushed. She thought she was flirting. The man regarded Ilka with his bright brown stare and asked,
like what do I look?
That, said Ilka, is what I'm not understanding. When I walk on Broadway and see an old Viennese pair, I can understand already from behind what the man has worked in Vienna, how it looked in their room. Ilka stopped, appalled at the number and complication of the English sentences ahead.
Go on, the man said.
She shook her head. Ilka meant that she recognized the proportions, height by width of the old man's Jewish back, which fit and failed to fit in the same places into the same suit Ilka's father wore to the shop. The fabric that upholstered the fat old wife was the navy cotton patterned with the same full-blown roses, bows, garlands, and violins of Great Aunt Marley's Sunday dresses. Those German pre-war cottons wore like iron and had outlasted Great Aunt Marley, as well as Ilka's father and three aunts, five uncles, and two of the cousins who used to gather for Aunt Marley's afternoons of café und Kugelhupf. Aunt Marley's oversized table had stood square in the middle of the room. The tile stove in the left corner gave off too much heat. The walls were dark and striped, the curtains lace, and the drapes flowered and fringed with black wooden beads, which little Ilka, lying on the Turkey carpet, cozy, too hot, bored, more than half asleep, had pulled off one after the other. Aunt Marley had sat drinking coffee and watching Ilka. Ilka shook her head and said, it's too complicated to tell it, but I look at you and...
Yes?
Ilka shook her head. She meant that she did not understand his hair, that the size of his mouth and his laughter did not go with the urbane bend of his wrist and the way he crossed his ankles, that the luxurious tweed of his jacket contradicted his wide nose and mouth. Ilka said, take, for example, these two Americans which are coming in by the door. She swiveled on her stool and watched the newcomers settle into the booth she had recently vacated. They called for Larry.
Couple beers, Larry.
One was a little shorter, with a big chest, the other a few years younger, perhaps. Both were in their 30s, of middling height,
and wore, it seemed to Ilka, their undershirts. They had ruddy arms and blunt, round heads, and they looked underdone, as if they'd been taken out prematurely and put down in the world. Ilka said, I look and I'm seeing two men, but I cannot imagine what they're making for a living or how dressed their wives or how it looks in their rooms. The one who was perhaps younger shouted, Larry, what's with Larry? And stuck his head out of the booth. He looked around the room. And the American on the stool said, keep talking, in a different high voice Ilka had not heard before. She turned to see what had happened. Nothing had happened. There was nothing different in the way he sat, with his ankles crossed, his right hand around the glass on the bar. He'd not moved so much as his eyes to take in the newcomers, but sat very still. Only his left arm, pivoting at the shoulder, brought the cigarette to his mouth and took it away again. In his new voice, pitched in the high, thin register of castrato, he said, I'll buy you dinner on Main Street. Oh, but, said Ilka, Larry makes already our sandwich, isn't it? And here came Larry with two foaming mugs, which he carried around the bar and across the floor. He set them on the table between the two men and slid into the booth next to the one with the big chest. This aborted and unexplained sandwich, Ilka laid away in the patient back part of the mind, where a child keeps things it doesn't know what to make of and other things it doesn't know it doesn't understand. There they lie, forgotten, but available to join with future information that will elucidate some, but not all. The man on the stool smoked his cigarette down to a nubbin, then took his wallet from his breast pocket. He said, we leave separately. Excuse me? Go out the door, turn left, walk to Main Street, and wait for me. I can wait in here, said Ilka. The man did not say anything. Ilka looked at him. Was it that his neck had thickened or shortened or withdrawn into his shoulders? Had the ears retracted? The head and shoulders had streamlined. Some outside pressure, failing to eliminate his person, had compacted it and reduced its size without affecting its bulk. He looked like a high-caliber torpedo. Ilka saw what she saw and stored it away in her mind. She said, yes, so then I will wait at the corner. He did not raise his head. He was busy with his wallet. Ilka collected her things and rose. We're not all white, was what she thought one of the men in the booth had said. She stopped and looked in, and the man with the chest was looking her straight in the eye. It was to her he was talking. Ilka said, excuse me? The other younger man, too, was looking at her. Ilka said, I am new in America and cannot so well understand. She smiled her sweet, apologetic smile and leaned closer to listen harder. And the man, looking her in the eye and enunciating very clearly, said it again. We are not all white. Ilka smiled. She shook her head. Either one of you fellas once in your lifetime got a lump sum? Did you ever have an opportunity? The barman was asking the two men as Ilka walked out of the door. The end of the town was deserted and dark, the way the blacked-out wartime cities of Europe had been dark, except for that same curious pink glow Ilka had observed in the night sky over Manhattan. She imagined that it emanated from the noisy neon lights of every Times Square or Main Street, floated upward and spread like a comforter of rosy and possibly noxious haze over America. Ilka walked to Main Street and waited. Presently, the big American from the bar stood at the curb beside her. He kept a slice of the night air between them. The purple mountain had been assumed into the blackness, which had pepped up the colored lights. Over the restaurant across the street, a blue cow blinked glamorous Disney lashes once, twice, and went out. The blue cow spelled itself in yellow capitals. Ilka felt excited and hilarious. On both thronging sidewalks, everyone was male and young.
I don't believe, I think this I have imagined, Ilka laughed.
She turned to the American. He was looking at her. He looked deliberately across the street and back at Ilka and said, we're standing here, side by side. But how do I know what you see?
This, Ilka said with a sensation of bliss, is what I am meaning.
She was afterward to identify this as the moment in which she fell in love. It coincided with a break in the traffic and his first slight touch under her elbow, an anachronistic courtesy that assumes the woman cannot step down into the street or make it safely to the other side without the man's supporting hand. He withdrew it as soon as he'd helped her up the curb.
Where would you like to eat?
I would like that you are choosing.
Right, he said.
He walked her past the blue car and past the bar and beef.
Are you afraid? He asked her.
No, said Ilka, because I'm with you.
With me? Uh-huh, the big American said, walking past the steak and swill and past Harry's hash.
But at the Versailles, no better it seemed to Ilka and no worse than the others, he opened and held the door.
Here by the window is good for looking, said the insatiable Ilka.
But the man walked her past the window table, walked past a second and a third empty table, and made a U-turn around a table from which three men had raised their eyes. The three men watched a large, middle-aged, yellow-skinned Negro march out the door, followed by a thin young blonde. Back in the street, he asked Ilka if she was hungry.
Not so hungry, said Ilka.
They walked past Harry's hash, and he turned and looked behind him. Ilka turned also. She said,
I don't understand what four men are all these.
Men, said the man. They passed the steak and swill. Good enough fellas, as fellas go, care for their kids, satisfy their wives some of the time, do their work well as can be expected, and pay their taxes mostly, go to church or not, and will string me up as soon as look at me.
String you?
Ilka did not understand him.
She said, I think soon I must again instep in the train, isn't it?
I'll wait with you, said the man. They walked past the bar and beef, past the blue cow. He held her elbow across the dirt road and assisted her up onto the platform. Aren't you afraid of me? The big American asked Ilka as they walked alongside the empty, darkened train.
Ilka thought about this and said, no.
They sat down on a bench underneath one of the half dozen lamps, weak and unsteady as gaslight, that made no inroads upon the darkness.
I would have liked to make love to you, said the American gloomily.
Ilka, who was not in the habit of receiving propositions, understood this one as a courtesy intended as a compliment. The man said, when a man hasn't so much as managed to buy a woman dinner, it's not conducive.
I'm not so hungry, said Ilka.
Well, 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 the American said. I owe you.
They exchanged addresses. He wrote Fishgoppel's telephone number into a well-worn leather-bound address book. On the corner of an envelope, he wrote the name of the hotel in New York, where he said he used to live and might take a room if they had one until he figured out what the hell he was doing.
There is my conductor, said Ilka.
When you get back to town.
Sunday, said Ilka.
Monday, I must go again to, I call it the Agency of Unemployment.
Ah, yes, indeed, the man said. He handed her up the steps into the train. When Ilka turned to say goodbye, she saw the droop of his face, and the sad expanse of his cheek grew large, larger, blurred. It filled Ilka's eyes, and Ilka's lips touched and depressed the male softness of his flesh, while her mind went scampering after something funny in English with which to unsay what she was doing here. Ilka laughed and said, This also I do not believe. You, I know, I imagined. And withdrew her head to the distance at which the features of his face resumed their surface and outline, with a difference. His wide-open, unblinking eyes looked, without a hint of irony and shameless with emotion, full into Ilka's face. Ilka ducked up the stairs, found her seat, and let the window down. When had the platform filled with so many people saying their goodbyes and getting onto the train? It took her a moment to identify the back of the American from the bar stool, already walking away.
We hope you've enjoyed Harriet Walter's reading of The First American by Laurie Siegel. If you did, please tell your friends about the Free Word Theater Short Story Podcast. And we urge you to become a contributing patron or enthusiast member. We need your support. You will get to enjoy monthly live streams and recordings of our live shows that take place in Los Angeles, New York, and London, and anywhere else we're invited. These live shows are available for viewing on your members page at your convenience. Special thanks to Jonathan Sachs for composing our theme music, and thank you to our podcast editor, Jason Lee. This is Cedaring Fox in the Cotswolds, UK. Until next week, signing off.